Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, my name is Gary Mansfield, and this is the Ministry of Arts podcast, where each week I'll be speaking to a different artist. Now let's begin by bagging these bongos. Hello, and welcome to episode 153 of the Ministry of Arts podcast. Firstly, as ever, a big thank you to our Patreon supporters, new and old, without whom we could not produce this podcast. A podcast that is all self-funded because we don't want to be governed by the advertisers. So if you like what you hear and you want to contribute towards keeping it going, go over to the Ministry of Arts Instagram profile. You'll find a drop-down box. There'll be a link there that directs you straight over to Patreon. It starts at just £3. And if you're not able, that's absolutely fine. This content is free for everyone. As mentioned last week, it's also that time of year when we're selling the Dark Stars. These are handmade barbed wire stars that come in black gloss, white, silver, gold and red. They're a limited edition of 30 and they're £90, including mainland post and packaging. And I should say, the black gloss have almost gone. And if you'd like one of these stars, just DM me on any of the socials at MizogArt, M-I-Z-O-G-A-R-T. And finally, this Friday, the 26th of November, at 6:30, I'll be hosting a poetry evening at the South Bank Centre. This is to celebrate the launch of Kersler's new book, Kersler Voices, New Poetry from Prisons, Volume 3. There's going to be several guest readers, one of whom is my good buddy Lady Unchained. That's this Friday, the 26th, at the South Bank Centre, and tickets are just £10. To get a ticket, just get in touch with Kersler Arts or contact us here at the Ministry of Arts and we'll point you in the right direction. But anyway, back to this week's episode. Today, I'm going to take you to meet Bren Simonsen. Bren is an artist that's worn many hats in the past, and a beret. He's one of the most acclaimed reportage photographers of the 21st century. He started his career in the 90s working alongside renowned photographers such as Gavin Bond, David LaChapelle and Navad Kander. And if that wasn't exciting enough, on top of that, in his mid-30s, he joined the Special Forces and toured with them in the Helmand province. He's now become best known as using actual AK-47s as his blank canvas. I first met Bren 3 or 4 years ago when I invited him to be a part of my Face Value exhibition, where he used live rounds in an actual AK-47 to produce text on a sheet of aluminium, which we speak about in this episode. So, with the motto for this episode being Who Dares Wins, come and join me over Zoom as I spoke to Bren Simonsen.
2-2, you've got SBS, and then you've got 18... 2-2 and 18 are based at Hereford.
Nice.
And then SB is obviously down in Poole on the coast. So, yeah, that's the regimen I was in.
I've got seven questions, Bren, that I ask each artist.
Uh-huh.
The first of which is, how would you explain what you do to someone that doesn't know your work?
How do I explain what I do? I stick stuff on stuff. I guess I would call myself a sculptor, because everyone loves to sort of put themselves into a pocket so people understand what they do. But for me, if it goes deeper, my explanation goes deeper, more sort of authentic to what I do. I would say that I sort of disarm something that creates harm. You know, it's taking something of danger and brutality and then turning it into something of sort of beauty and intrigue, you know, using the gun as a blank canvas. That would be my overall reply.
And it's no normal gun, is it? You know, it's probably the most famous of armed...
Well, yeah, I mean that has a large factor to do with it, because obviously when I was in Afghanistan and back when I went back there again, and then when I went to Iran and lots of places that have been, there's been a lot of conflict in Africa, and I was on the Somalian border in Kenya when that was all kicking off, photographing for GQ. That everyone's got an AK-47. It's the most symbolic weapon in the world. So that for me was a very powerful and appealing weapon to use, because it's like the Coca-Cola bottle. It's like the $1 bill. They're just all instantly recognizable the second you see it. You could show a silhouette of an AK-47 to someone that doesn't even know about weapons, and they'll know what it is.
Yeah.
And they symbolize so much: the freedom, revolution, terrorism. So that's why I use that. I often get asked to apply what I do to other weapons, but so far I've sort of restrained from doing that.
Well, as you say, it's symbolic shape. When you cover it in butterflies, for instance, you can see none of the gun, but it's still a rough silhouette, and you can still distinguish it as an AK-47.
Depending on the weapon and the provenance of where it came from, sometimes they've got writing on or they've got battle scars on. So I try and show that off sometimes, to sort of remind people that they have come from conflict zones. And other times they haven't. And depending on the piece, I'll either choose to completely immerse it with butterflies and hide the fact it's a gun. And in other pieces, I'll show off that it's a weapon, and I'll intrinsically show parts of that weapon that would mean something to the voyeur.
Yeah. How do you come by them? How do you obtain the AK-47s themselves?
I've got a number of guys that specialise in weapons within the UK. I know that sounds odd, but there are...
Yeah, I know a bloke down at the Green Lion who can get hold of something as well.
I think that's a sawn-off shotgun. I've got guys that sort of... They either specialise in weapons or they specialise in deactivation of weapons. Yeah. So for collectors, you know, because it's a big world. You know, you think of all the wars and the conflicts and the old flintlock pistols, and everything needs to be deactivated. So they buy in weapons, and lots of people approach them. And then there's other guys that do actually specialize in buying and selling weapons. You know, they supply the police, they supply all sorts of people. So I go to them and I say, you know, can you get me some AK-47s? And then they'll reach out and see what's available and what's come through. They always land in the UK fully serviceable. They're usable weapons. You know, and I've cocked and dry fired them and checked them out. I've even fired a couple on a range, but I had to be employed by that company to be able to do that, to get a special license. And then they're deactivated, and then they're sent to a proof house. They're stamped and proven they're deactivated, so they can't be reactivated at all. And then I get them and then start my work on them.
Well, you said there about firing them at a range, which is how we first met a few years ago.
That's right.
with when you was part of the Face Value.
Yeah, because I shot up
Ben Ayn.
Ben Ayn's piece, didn't That's I? It.
Yeah, it was, so Ben Ayn donated a stencil. You put it on a large sheet of aluminium.
Yes.
And then just, what was it you fired into it? It was why? Was it why?
I think it was the word why with a question mark. That's yes, it. As in why would you do this?
Yeah, it was for Katie Piper's, Katie Piper Foundation.
That's right, yeah.
And
yeah,
in the end, she bought it herself. So she.
Oh, did you? I didn't know that.
Oh, you didn't? Oh, I thought you was aware of that. She.
No, I didn't know that.
I thought I told you, sorry. Yeah, she's got it indoors every now and then.
That's like, right,
she puts
that's right.
a post up. She'll be standing in front of it.
Yeah,
you know?
That's great that she ended up with that art piece.
Yeah, brilliant. And oh, you cool. sent me a little, I don't know if you remember, you sent a little video of it, the work in progress. I sent her that over once I found out that she had bought it, and she was quite impressed with the little video of it.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. Well, that those were the early days of me testing that project and how to do that out. And then that led on to the... I did a collaboration with Terry O'Neill.
Oh, yeah.
Called Hollywood Reloaded. And I basically took famous portraits of people that he'd shot, he'd photographed. One of the most well-known ones that was in the show and that he's ever taken is that famous image of Michael Caine with the shotgun out of Get Carter. Yeah.
Nice.
So... I got this guy in the UK to source all the same weapons that the actors are holding in that photograph.
Nice.
Whether it be a ball-loaded hammer action pistol. I did Roger Moore, so I got the original PPK pistol he's holding. Michael Caine was the hammer action shotgun. And then even I did, there was a picture of David Bailey with Kiss. I think it's Kiss, the band, and they're all holding SMG submachine guns. And nice. I did that as well.
Wow.
And it was the whole project was really about showing the voyeur how guns are glorified in film and how we don't really see the true damage of what they make. So I put all the images on a metal sheet. So once the bullet went into it, the bullet hole or the score would stay there. And show the damage of what weapons can actually do.
Well, the one you've done with Katie Piper, you had the sunshine in the background. And because the image you were shooting was just the artwork itself, as soon as you heard the ping of the bullet going through, then all of a sudden there was a bright shard of light coming through from the back as well, wasn't there?
Yeah, and dramatic. I did look good there.
Because you've also filled custom-made bullets, haven't
you?
Yeah,
well, in each artwork... The magazine's cut away, and then there's generally a between 7 and 8 clear glass rounds, which is modeled from the 7.62 round that goes in most AKs, and then I fill that with symbolic fillings to do with the narrative of the artwork.
And what sort of fillings have you put in those?
Oh, everything from sand, Berlin Wall, honey. Cocaine, just depends on what the artwork is. So the environmental ones tend to be what's destroyed the planet or what good is being done, like sawdust to represent deforestation, honey to represent the death of bees, and then the spores of war, it's more about conflict. So opium poppy seeds that I brought back from Afghanistan, cocaine, gold, diamonds. And then when I get a private commission, quite often, just recently, I made a white AK-47 for someone covered in white butterflies because he wanted it to symbolize his grandmother that passed away.
Oh, wow.
And so I just sat down with him and just spoke about him and his family, their background, what meant something to them, the kid's name. So I put... like the birthstones of their child's birthday in the bullets. And he did this crazy marathon through the Sahara Desert. So I got someone to get me some sand from the Sahara Desert and send it to me. And then I put that in the bullet, you know. So I try and make the artwork personal to them.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we're moving on. We are going to be doing necklaces the bullet necklaces filled with symbolic fillings. Some guy reached out to me and said he'd like one with his brother's ashes in there. So we're going to do like an organic range where we fill it with things that mean something to someone, you know.
Oh, nice.
And then we're going to do a range with sort of precious stones in and stuff. But yeah.
Nice. Did you always have art growing up in the home?
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, my dad was, he used to teach art, funnily enough, my real father. And then my stepfather was very, he was artistic, but a lot of his family were draftsmen, designers. My mum was quite artistic. So, I sort of leaned more towards that than academia, you know. Because I was dyslexic as a child, so I sort of struggled retaining that information that you needed to do at school. You know, so, I struggled with the times table, but I'd sort of learn about the bees and the butterflies and Mother Nature more. You know what I mean?
Was you making art when you enlisted?
No, well, I was working as a photographer. So that was my field, and that was what I wanted to do. So I was working as a photographer in the field, taking portraits, working as a commercial photographer as well. I wasn't physically making artwork then. That only really came about in 2012.
So when you was in Afghanistan fighting, would you be documenting at the same time?
Yeah, I mean, because I was a photographer anyway, and we were a reservist regiment, but because we came under the umbrella of Special Forces, that's a no-no for taking cameras out on the field.
I can imagine, yeah.
Because obviously you've got to protect everyone's identity and stuff. That being said, every other fucker had a camera on
there. Yeah.
Because everyone wants that alley photograph of them.
Course.
You know, but I was sort of dubbed the official photographer of the regiment on that tour. So
yeah,
I took my large Canon SLR camera out with me, but then I also had a little camera in my webbing. So when I had downtime, I'd be taking pictures of the environment, where we were living, day-to-day life, you know, because it was new to me as well. So it was an experience. And then when we were out on foot patrol, like denying the Taliban of movement and stuff, and we were going out on little missions and stuff, I would, if I had the opportunity, I would pull it out and snap away, you know. But it was quite hard, because obviously when I was patrolling, you have the mentality of a soldier and you have the mentality of a photographer. So there was often I would want to go, oh shit, there's an amazing photo there, but I couldn't stop, you know.
Yeah, because I'm being fired at.
Yeah, I mean, there was always this joke where we were taking cover in a ditch and some rounds were going over, and I was just sat there and I was just like, and I just started taking pictures, and they were like what the fuck are you doing? And I'm like, well, what else am I gonna do, you know? It's, yeah, like
when I said bring out the cannon, Bren, what I meant was
yeah, not the camera. But yeah, but It was amazing being able to be in that situation and take photographs. And then obviously when the whole Afghan thing came back up and we, you know, America suddenly left and it was all, yeah, in the news, then a lot of my mates were kind of getting in touch and being like, oh, you know, that's all a bit crazy. And then it made me kind of dig through my archive of images and just, I just saw a lot of stuff I hadn't seen in a long time, you know. And then the weight of what I took back then became a lot stronger, because that's like, you know, there's a lot of memories there, you know.
Yeah.
What happened was I was obviously taking portraits of these guys, and that's when I started noticing this character called the Chai Boy, which was basically this very effeminate guy within the group of police, who would wear eyeliner, he'd dye his hands with henna, and he would basically be this feminine mascot almost, but then he would often sexually service a lot of the guys because they weren't mixing with women.
Yeah,
it wasn't even like as how we would know in our society. It was like, oh, homosexual, you're gay, you're straight. It was just they were very feminine, and they would often seek sexual gratification between them. So for us, that was quite a shock at first, you know. And it generally happened on a Thursday night because Friday was prayer day. So we used to nickname it Man Love Thursday. but these guys would walk around and they'd be out on patrol with us. And it was hard to take them seriously as well because, like, they're, you know, they were brave, they were gung-ho, but like any 16-year-old would be, 15-year-old would be, you know, generally the youngest in the group. He'd be waving his AK around and we'd have to sort of grip him and be like, stop fucking pointing that in my direction, you know. And they were great characters. They were friendly. Taking portraits of them was a great way of winning over their trust because they loved the attention. And it was very novel for them, you know, them seeing their image on the back of a digital screen was completely revolutionary for them. Because they didn't have that technology then, you know. We started seeing these guys decorating their AK-47s, putting roses in them. And I was just like, wow, this is amazing, you know. So when I could, which wasn't very often, I would take their portraits. And then I started cataloguing this whole world within a world. And I think everyone was used to these gung-ho images of guys jumping out of helicopters and those dusty schnooks landing. And no one had really seen this sort of feminine, beautiful side of Afghanistan, which was basically just guys with AK-47s.
Yeah. Well, the image that we get of Afghanistan, people who haven't been there, we just get the image off of the news. And that image is just constantly negative, isn't it? You know, it's people being shot or being shot at. There's not much more of a narrative going on than that.
Their culture's not really touched on that much. I mean, even though I've been there twice and watched a lot of films on the place, I still see images of Afghanistan and get blown away. I'm like, oh, you know, because we didn't even touch on that kind of terrain. You know, there's forests everywhere. And we were very dry and in the desert because we were in Helmand province. But it's a massively diverse and beautiful country. And I do think it's very sad that it's been put in the shit state it has. You
know? Well, I met several people who travelled there in the 80s and they were saying it was like the most fantastic place on earth. Not only the surroundings, but the people as well, like the friendliest people that ever come across, you know.
Really friendly, really friendly. I mean, I think that was the problem, is like even the Taliban were friendly, but then you walk down the road and they'd be trying to start shooting at you. But no, I mean, it was a hippie trail. Like, people were going there in the 60s. If you dig up images of Afghanistan in the 60s, there's Afghani women walking around with miniskirts and school books going to school on a normal high street. And sadly, the extremism of religion and men have turned it into a shit show.
Yeah, that sums it up pretty much, doesn't it? Yeah, so you started decorating the AK-47.
Mm-hmm.
And that got a lot of traction because you included other artists as well, didn't you?
Yeah, so that my initial idea when I was sort of more photography based, I sort of came up with this concept of doing a group show and basically giving an AK-47 to different artists. I mean, this is back in 2012, and I think that concept of giving things to artists and is quite the norm now, but not many people have done it, especially not a weapon. So not knowing much about the art world, I just started reaching out to people. Got a couple of people on board to help me. Then got in touch with the Chapman brothers, and they were very good at reaching out to people like Sarah Lucas, Anthony Gormley, and all these big hitters. And half of them I hadn't even heard of. And I literally had a deactivated AK-47 in my bag, and I was turning up at these artist studios saying, this is it, do you want to get on board? And a lot of them would laugh, do the classic, I'll take a picture of me holding it.
Of course.
And then they'd be like, yeah, crack on. And then, you know, we reached out to Damien Hirst quite early on, because obviously when you do a project like this, we all know that you need some big names on board. Yeah. It's, you know, it's that band-aid effect, isn't it? It's like, well, I won't do it if he doesn't do it. And then the irony was he said no to it. And then they got in touch with us a couple of months later, and they were like, well, actually, yeah, no, we want to do it now because everyone else have got on board.
Yeah.
So that culminated in a big auction. It was shown at the ICA, but it was while I was doing that, I was doing it as an organizer stroke photographer. And then suddenly I was just like, well, hang on, why don't I do one? You know,
of course.
And so that's when I put my hand to my first artwork, came up with the concept, really enjoyed the process. And then I think my piece on a silent auction sold for, it was ridiculous. It was like 20 grand or something.
Nice.
And I think overall that night we raised 550,000.
Fucking hell.
Yeah, well, no, it was insane. But really my main intention, my go-to, was to be able to photograph and take portraits of all these artists and their artwork. That's what I wanted to get out of it. And I was like, oh yeah, I could do a book and make a book from this, and then I'll do something else. And mate, after that, the phone rung off the hook with other charities wanting me to get on board and do stuff for them. And so for quite a long time, I was kind of swimming around this pool of ex-military, I want to be a photographer, but now I really like the sound of being an artist. Or do I become a fundraiser, you know?
And yeah.
I was getting pulled in all different directions. And I didn't actually physically make another artwork. It was about probably a year later, year and a half later.
What was the first one? Was it the blue one?
No, the first one I ever did was the one covered in dollar bills. But literally, when I look back at it now, it's like proper Blue Peter. It's just like I've literally got whole dollar bills and put them on. But now I intricately cut all the design out with a scalpel and like they're completely embellished and I spend weeks on them. But
you're a different kind of artist now, Bren, aren't you? You know?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think every artist grows and learns from their own mistakes. And I've done that. You know, I didn't have any training. I didn't have anyone looking over me saying, that's how you do that. You know, like from using glues, resins, different materials, you know. I've probably been working solid now for the last 2 months, like every day, smashing workout. I probably haven't physically made an artwork in 2 months. I just made, I've been making a piece recently, which is, it's a giant love heart suite. You know, I don't know, it's like 20 centimeters across. And in it, it says, die for you. And then around that is going to be surrounded with AK-47 bullets.
Wow.
And and then the brown mat is going to be surrounded by AK-47 magazines. But I needed over 1,000 bullets. And the only way to do that was to go to this armory guy that I buy my AKs off. He gave me 1,000 live bullets and I had to deactivate each bullet by hand. Wow. Which you put it in this special hammer, you whack it, the bullet head comes out, you tip out the gunpowder, then you fire the percussion cap off. You had to individually load them into the weapon. You fire the percussion cap off, which is like the tiny little explosion that ignites the gunpowder. And then I had to then hit the bullet head back into the round. Now you do that 1,000 times.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, you get those moments when you're like, look at me, Mar, I'm an artist.
Yeah, I wish I was like, a fucking photographer.
Yeah, and you just think, you know, half this shit people don't see or get, you know. Yeah. But I love it. Yeah, you know, I was enjoying it, but it does make me laugh. It's just, it's sort of, I think people see a finished art piece and go, oh yeah, okay, AK-47 covered in butterflies. Yeah, I could do that.
Yeah.
And I'm like, fucking crack on, mate. Have a go.
Yeah, that's the famous line, isn't it? I can do that.
Yeah.
Which one that you've created has got the strongest emotional connection, do you reckon?
Oof, good question. I guess the classic well-known image I took in Afghanistan is the guy stood there with the roses in his AK-47 looking straight into the camera. I think the reason for that is that was taken at Satellite Station North, which was in Helmand Province in Imbu Sakala. And in the background, there's a mountain and we nicknamed that Mount Doom. And we spent a lot of time there. It was in the middle of nowhere. We were overlooking the opium poppy fields when they were all flowering. So it was very beautiful, but very hot and very dry. And then when we were up in Mount Doom, we were in a big contact with the Taliban, and sadly we lost one of my we lost one of our guys up there who was actually a very good friend of mine. So I have that emotional contact when I see that image. But then as a photographer, that image was used on the front cover of the Sunday Times, which then on to be a part of the fest, the best 50 ever covers of the Sunday Times.
Nice.
Which was a proud moment of mine.
And he's had some bloody covers as well, hasn't he?
Yeah, and then it was used for Christina Lamb, which is she's a very well-regarded war reporter from Afghanistan. She wrote a book called Farewell Kabul, and she used that for the front cover as well. So that as a photograph, I think is probably the one I'm proud of. And then I think jointly my mixed butterfly AK-47 and the dollar bill one. Those are my seminal pieces.
Yeah.
Each one of them is always completely unique. I always add a little bit more flair to them as I'm learning the process more. And so I think those are the two works that are kind of categorize my stuff, you know.
We've already spoke about your photography, your sculpture, and you mentioned about picking up bits of the earth or sand or some of even the environment to bring back. Just sort of like keeping your own archive. The show you've got coming up, The Arts of Disarm, at the House of Fine Art in Mayfair, that is a sort of mini retrospective, wouldn't you say?
No, it totally is, but I'm trying to keep away from the word retrospective because I don't feel like I deserve that yet because I haven't been going long enough, but it is a mini one. Yeah. I'm kind of referring it more to as looking back to see where I am now, you know. Yeah. I'm glancing over my shoulder to see the birth of where it really began for me, which was in Afghanistan, even though I was a photographer already. And then the journey since to where I am now, and seeing all different elements of what I've done and seeing everything in one room, because it's hard to believe, but and everyone gets a shock when I say this, but I've not seen more than three of my artworks physically in one room together.
Brilliant.
When I make a piece, the gallery picks it up, it's sold, it's gone.
Yeah.
And then they'll put that image up on the website, and they'll go, you know, and someone will go, oh, I really want one of these. So it's only ever been art fairs in Miami or Texas, and a couple of times in London when I've popped into gallery where they've had 2, 3, maximum 4 of my works on the floor with other artworks. And for the past few years now, I've been trying to do a solo show. You know, obviously last year was wiped out because of COVID. The year before that, I got too busy. And the year before that, I got too busy. And I just said, right, whatever happens, I need to do this. And then when Afghanistan kicked off, it then also planted a seed to kind of go, well, this is quite timely, you know.
Yeah.
Because there's quite a lot of reflection on that area of the world. So, yeah, I mean, for me, it's going to be quite a moment when I'm stood there surrounded by all my works, you know, and thinking, okay, this is what I do, you know, this is who I am. And being able to look, because I'm sure I'll look at some stuff and I'll be like, oh, that looks awesome. And I'm probably look at some stuff and go, yeah, I'm not sure about that now, you know. So it's almost a kind of almost drawing a line in the sand a little bit, you know, because I'm going to be featuring 3 new moving digital NFTs there as well.
Yeah, nice.
So I'm literally taking that medium and turning it into digital format. So there's literally photography to NFTs there and sculptures. So it's going to be, it's going to be interesting. I'm also doing a little memorabilia box of all the stuff I collected when I was on my tour of duty, you know, like hand grenade pins, bullet casings, maps, bits and pieces. So I'm going to have that as like a little point of interest to show people, like kind of, like where it was. I think I've even got my original camera that I used with some little camo tape that I stuck on it. So, yeah.
So were you pulling it literally out of your archives? it's almost like a little museum show, if you like, isn't it? You know, with remnants. Yeah,
It's I would say it's half and half. Half of it is new works and works that I've made in the past 5 months.
Yeah.
My gallery they've got a gallery in Mykonos. So I made a piece for there. And fortunately enough, we were able to get that back. So that's going to be in the show. And just working with new ideas and concepts, not even breaking boundaries, just developing what I do and moving it on slightly. I want to do a lot more work with currency, but just not really had the opportunity to, yeah. Factoring in time, personal life, family life, you know, and at the end of the day, just juggling a business. There's only so much you can do in a day, right? So it's kind of frustrating. But I've started changing my practice and how I work, so allows me more time to get more creative as well. Yeah. So
anyone who will be visiting the Arts of Disarm at the House of Fine Art in Mayfair. You haven't curated the show yet.
Well, I've curated it in a sense that I've put together all these works that I want to be in the show. But I haven't curated it in the sense that I'm sitting in the room working out what's going to look best where. Yeah. I mean, obviously there's sections, you know, like, so we'll have my Afghan photography.
Yeah, nice.
We'll have those Die For You large love heart suites. And each colour, there's six colours, each colour has its own narrative. One's about camaraderie within the army, one's about freedom of speech, one's about love of family. So all this information will be on the wall. We're going to cue code things as well, so people can hold up their phone and involve a bit of technology, and then they can read up stuff. There's going to be one of my embellished AK-47 prints, embellished with butterflies, and then there's going to be all different works involving origami, real butterflies, currency, and then the NFTs as well. Yeah, so there's quite a broad spectrum of different works there. But fundamentally, they're all AK-47s.
Sorry, that runs from the 25th of November to the 9th of December.
26th. 25th is the private view, which I hope you can come along to. That's going to be a good night, because it's just going to be a lot of my old army mates, people within the art industry, friends.
Nice.
So that's like a private view night and an opportunity for me to actually be there and see it all. And then from the 26th to the 9th, it's open to the general public. But I will be down there on days, just like meeting clients and doing stuff. So I said to the gallery, look, if anyone wants to talk through the work or learn more, I'll be in the area. You know, I'm happy to sort of do a walkthrough, talk through some of the works, you know, because people don't always get all the layers of the
of
the messages behind it and stuff. So, and you know, I mean, what artist doesn't like to blow his own fucking trumpet?
Of course, I totally agree. We've already mentioned the Art to Disarm. Have you got anything else coming up?
Yeah, it's called Kalash 47. I've been working on it pretty much for most of the year. And that is turning AK-47 artworks into the NFT world. We're going to drop approximately about 1,900 to 2,000 of them.
Wow.
Which is a small number within the NFT world. Normally they're dealing with 10,000 drops and stuff. So we wanted to make it very unique and specific. What makes this NFT drop different is we are actually dealing with the real image. It hasn't been digitally created.
Yeah.
I went to an armory. I individually photographed all the different AK-47s and their variations, whether it be a Draco, snub nose, short barrel, folding stock, with a bayonet, with a telescopic sight, with a laser sight. And then all the different categories will be on those AK-47s. And then they're decorated with things that mean something to me. So like the Die For You suites, Bruce Lee stickers, butterflies fluttering around them.
Nice, yeah.
And then they'll have rarity traits as well. And then within that, so apart from the actual physical AK-47s I photographed and created these specific works with, then within that, there are my actual physical AK-47 works photographed. Wow. And then we've embellished those. So say the blue AK-47 covered in blue butterflies, we've then got blue butterflies fluttering around it. But what makes this difference is I photographed all the butterflies. I photographed everything, every element on there, and then painstakingly sat there with a guy saying, right, I want that there, I want that there. So technically he took care of that, moving the mouse around and stuff, but everything was done in-house, which I'm sort of quite proud of, but it was a lot of work. And then we're going to have some rare ones thrown into the mix. So yeah, so that's my next big thing after the exhibition.
And how was it stepping into that new world?
Well, every day is a school day, mate. I mean, I'm having some conversations with people knowing everything I'm talking about, and then someone will just throw a curveball at me and say a name, and I'll be like, what the fuck's he talking about? But I just have to be honest every time and just say, could you explain that to me, please? But yeah, it's mad. It's a mad, mad world because it's connected to so many things. It's like, okay, you've got the NFT, right? So that's the digital token of that art piece, which comes with all its history. So then you're talking about all the history that that piece has, and you can see who's bought it, who sold it. Then you're touching on cryptocurrency to actually physically buy the thing in the first place.
Yeah.
Then you have to have a MetaMask wallet to have the cryptocurrency. Then you're part of the blockchain. Then you have to pay gas fees. So it's quite daunting at first, but once you get it all set up, it's a fascinating world because you're crossing over gamers, art collectors, and collectors. I was trying to explain it to a mate yesterday, and I was just like sort of saying, imagine a Pokemon card that is a piece of artwork. And someone wants to financially invest in it. You're getting all these worlds molded into one, but everyone's talking about NFTs right now, but the percentage of people that are physically buying and selling them is tiny.
Yeah.
And when I first started learning about it, it was like, oh, it's just going to be a fad, but I think it's going to revolutionize a lot. And then you're talking about the meta universe and everything that's going on, creating this second universe. Just like, have you seen the film Ready Player One?
No.
It's a great film. Watch it. And that's pretty much what's happening now. You know, less the fact that it's in the future. You know, I think that the metaverse is going to be the next massive revolution.
Yeah.
I was studying about some cryptocurrency last night on YouTube, and this guy made a very valid point. You know, he says, whoever is saying this is a fad, you know, why are all the largest companies in the world investing billions into it?
Yeah.
You know, they're not going to wake up next week and go, oh, fuck it, let's move on to the next thing.
No.
It's all linked. It's not just, oh, it's NFTs. It's linked to cryptocurrency. Then it's linked to what that market's doing at the time. And so that's why people are exchanging NFTs for vast amounts of money, because it is just a big investment as well, which I find interesting. And it is going to completely regulate the art world a lot more.
Yeah.
And also, I think galleries are going to become more of a shop front than controlling the art world. And I think it's going to bring a lot of empowerment to artists because they're able to go and do their own thing. I mean, obviously it's hitting, you know, the music industry is getting really involved in it. All these big baseball, football, basketball teams are getting into it and selling off, you know. So it's like I said, it's like collector cards meets the art world meets like the financial world, you know. So it is very fascinating, and it races so quickly as well. You know, there's a lot going on all the time. So, but yeah, but that's the thing. I think there's a lot of people that are put off by it right now. But I think Instagram is going to be creating something where you can take a picture and instantly turn it into an NFT. I think it's like anything, it's just accessibility, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we're so like it's moving so quickly, and I think we are really at the forefront of everything that's going on. Everyone within the NFT world is learning, making mistakes, realizing that, putting them right, you know. So it's a little bit nerve-wracking that I will be doing this drop, because you are entering a world that you don't know much about, but you're just, I think it's just important to stay true to yourself,
yeah,
and be a creative. And if anyone's got any techie stuff to ask me, then I'll scurry away and learn about it.
What do you think you'd do if you wasn't an artist?
Oh, good question. I trained as a chef. So I guess something like that, you know, or anything outdoorsy. I mean, I toyed with the idea of being a landscape gardener, or I know it sounds a bit Miss World, but kind of working with animals, you know. I just wanted to do something creative, you know. I'm definitely not the 9-to-5 office type.
I can see one of the Die For You.
Oh yeah, that's it.
Behind you on the wall there.
Yeah, I'll grab it. Look, and then you can get an idea of the scale. Yeah, there you go.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I see you putting them up a little while ago.
Yeah, yeah. So that's it. And I'm going to do an edition of them.
Isn't it funny? No matter, even though that's massively out of scale from the original suite. What's that? 12 inches.
Yeah, about that, yeah.
Whenever you see them, you can still fucking taste the chalky fruitiness of them, can't
that's
you?
That's right.
You know?
Oh, it's funny to say chalky, because that's the finish we've really gone for, and even like the chipped edge.
Yeah, nice.
Because I've always had a fascination with scale. I love things that are small that are big, and things that are big that are small.
Yeah.
I think it's a childhood thing. Making these large was a lot of fun making them. And they're made of this really good resins. They're quite expensive to make, but the color doesn't fade. We're doing additions of 50 of each color, so that excellent. Once they're gone, that's it. But it's a solid piece, and it comes in a beautiful presentation box. And I'm trying within the exhibition, I've got a few one-off pieces there, so I'm trying to kind of make the affordability across the the affordable wallet size, you know, because my big sculptures sort of tend to go for a lot more money.
Well, unfortunately, when you're going for a gallery, the affordability
plummets.
Is a bit hard sometimes. Yeah, and that's just
the
way of the world.
That's why we started Baffle Boutique. Me and my missus started Baffle Boutique, which was basically online prints. Limited edition prints of my artworks, which have proven really popular, with the army guys as well, you know, because they like buying them as well. And then that's sort of grown to small artworks.
I
do these hand embellished grenades with butterflies on and stuff. So that's been a good opportunity to sell my own work, but not conflict with what the gallery's doing as well.
Yeah. But finally, Bren, where can anyone find out about Bren Simonson, be it social media or website?
Oh, just go to my, if you just put in brensimonson.com.
Oh, sorry, I said Simonson.
No, it's fine. Everyone does, mate. It's just under my name, Bransymondson. My Instagram, Twitter, and my website. On the website, there's background, biog, and stuff of what I've done, and images of what we've spoken about, and obviously the link to the Baffle Boutique. And then we're setting up a page with just a brief outline of the exhibition, the Art to Disarm, dates, and gallery address and stuff. Baffle Boutique has its own Instagram.
Okay, Instagram. I'll include that on the show notes as well. So that...
Yeah, that's amazing. Thanks. Yeah, and then Baffle Boutique is just a part of the website, but it is also its own thing. So you can put in Baffle Boutique and you'll go there, or you'll see the link within the website to Baffle Boutique. But it's literally www.brensimonson.com.
Yeah.
And my website will come up.
Well, Bren, that's all my questions asked. Thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you. Nice
right
one.
Then, Bren. Thank
all
you
right,
very
bud.
Much.
Have a good day, yeah?
And you. See you later.
Cheers, buddy. Bye-bye. See you, mate.
Well, hope you enjoyed that episode of the Ministry of Arts podcast. If you're unable to support us on Patreon, leaving a review on whichever platform you listen to this podcast really does help us get noticed and anyone else looking for an art podcast, or even giving us a positive shout out on your social media. Anything is appreciated, but either way, thanks for listening, and until next week, ta-da.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.